The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the New York Times. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. New technology and techniques now allow us to not only travel to physical sites, but also travel back in time to learn about unique and often mysterious places. Rediscovering the Ancient Empire That History Forgot is written by Andrew Curry and appeared in the May 2025 issue of the National Geographic. Now, a photo caption is going to tell us what to expect, so let me grab my National Geographic, and it reads, "They fought the Egyptians and sacked Babylon. They built elaborate cities across modern Turkey and beyond, and then the Hittites vanished, lost to history for thousands of years. But today, new discoveries are restoring the legend of a forgotten superpower." Now let's learn more as we start with Andrew Curry's article. At its height, the ancient city of Hattusa, capital of the Hittite civilization, must have been awe-inspiring. Built into a steep hillside in what is today central Turkey, or Turkey, the city was ringed by tall brick walls. It was home to as many as 7,000 people, vast temple complexes, and an imposing stone rampart visible from miles away. Today, the hillside is home to a mystery. No pillars or high walls mark the ruins of the palace and the temples that once stood, just stone foundations half covered by dry grass. Some of the city's gates still stand, guarded by statues of lions, sphinxes, and an axe-wielding god, but much is gone. The mud brick walls have crumbled over the centuries. Floods and snowmelt have eroded the original hillside, sending buildings full of clay tablets cascading down the slopes. Fainter still are the clues that might explain what happened to the powerful Hittite people, a lost empire that researchers are now beginning to understand with greater clarity. The disappearance of the Hittites around 1180 BC was a vanishing act with few parallels in history. For at least 450 years, the Hittites controlled much of modern-day Turkey and beyond, from close to the shores of the Black Sea to the rivers of Mesopotamia and the waters of the Mediterranean. They built sophisticated cities, impressive temples, and an elaborate palace in the rugged countryside of Anatolia. They authored massive archives of cuneiform tablets containing numerous ancient languages and sacred rituals. Their kings benefited from trade routes that reached far beyond the Hittite homeland. Their armies once even penetrated deep into Mesopotamia. Their tangle with Egypt's Ramesses the Great at the Battle of Kadesh resulted in the world's first peace treaty. They were able to fight the Egyptians, and the Babylonians and Assyrians had to treat them as equals, said Andreas Schachner of the German Archaeological Institute, which has been carrying out digs at the Hattusa site for nearly a century. Yet the Egyptians, the Assyrians, they were all part of historical memory. The Hittites were extinguished completely, he said. Scholars didn't register the Hittites' existence until 3,000 years later, when carvings at ancient Egyptian temples and diplomatic correspondence discovered on clay tablets set off an international hunt for the location of their capital. Little remained of the suspected site besides monumental foundations, but digs there in the early 1900s unearthed a trove of clay cuneiform tablets confirming suspicions that Hattusa was the lost Hittite capital. From what they've continued to unearth at Hattusa, a once vibrant center of commerce, culture, and conquest, researchers have compiled an eloquent record of life in the empire. They have assembled details on everything from royal squabbles and religious ceremonies to the proper punishment for killing a dog. Yet the causes for the empire's collapse remain mysterious. How did the mighty Hittites vanish without a trace? And what can their sudden end teach us today? Between early June and late October, Schachner spends 7 days a week crisscrossing Hattusa and overseeing a team of Turkish and German archaeologists, as well as scores of local workers. He traverses the city's hills in a battered passenger van, his black dog Knox routinely at his side. As director of German Archaeological Institute's excavations, he's been making sense of the site's jumbled ruins since 2006. Nothing is in its original place, Schachner said with a sigh. There's so much destruction. One day, not long ago, I joined him at the city's great temple complex, a hub of ritual spaces, courtyards, storerooms, and secret chambers, not far from where Hattusa's northern gates are. I followed him as he wound through the waist-high stone blocks, gesturing upward now and again to refer to the plastered and possibly painted walls that would have towered 30 feet above our heads. He took me to a space once considered the center of the Hittite universe, the great temple, dedicated to the storm god Tahona and his partner, the sun goddess Arena. Foundations surrounding the temple preserve the outlines of 80 storerooms that previously contained vessels full of wine, water, and grain. Researchers have discovered inventories hinting at the riches stored in the temple's treasury. When the king came back from a campaign, all the booty was for the storm god, Schachner told me. He would have brought it here. One question that Schachner hopes to resolve is why the Hittites situated their capital here. There are worse places than central Anatolia to base an empire, but not as many. Halfway between the Black Sea and the deserts of Syria, Hattusa sits in a land of unlikely extremes. Freshwater springs are abundant and the rocky, virtually unfarmable mountains nearby. The region's few plains, on the other hand, are bone dry, most of the year, unless they're submerged by seasonal floods. Close reading of Hittite texts combined with environmental data shows that droughts grip the region every few decades, regularly pushing populations to the brink of starvation and beyond. Archaeologist Bulent Jenk, who works with Schachner at Hattusa, frames the mystery of why the city was built here with bemused admiration. Considering the climate and surroundings, it's mind-blowing that they had all this here, said Jenk, who teaches at Turkey's Mardin Artukulu University. The real question is, how did they build an empire in the middle of this central Anatolian hell? The answer, a combination of resilience, adaptation, and planning. For the centuries that they reigned, the lords of Hattusa managed to squeeze just a little more out of the land than anyone else before or since. Based on what we know of herding practices and the myriad animal bones found at Hattusa, Schachner thinks the surrounding hills supported tens of thousands of sheep and goats, providing a four-footed alternative to the irrigation-dependent farms that supported Egypt and Mesopotamia. To supply water for industrial and agricultural uses, the Hittites cut storage ponds into Hattusa's hillsides. Dug into clay soil to be filled by groundwater, some were longer than the Olympic swimming pool and up to 26 feet deep, immense airtight underground pits. Meanwhile, contained enough grain to feed their animals in periods of drought. All of this infrastructure was surrounded by strong walls that ran for an astonishing 4 miles along the city perimeter, engineered to contend with the hilly terrain, steep slopes, and deep ravines. Between 2003 and 2006, a 71-yard-long segment of it was reconstructed using only materials that would have been available to the Hittites, including wood, rock, and 3,000 tons of mud brick. Based on this experiment, researchers calculated that building just a half mile of wall would have taken 1,000 men a year, a stunning feat of logistics. Touring the site with Schachner, I rode along as he piloted his van up a twisting one-lane road to reach Hattusa's highest spot. Here, the city's most impressive building project survives. Yerkape, an elongated rampart standing 130 feet high and 820 feet long. The white stone embankment features a narrow gate decorated with sphinx statues. Adding to its imposing visual impact, a portion of the city's protective wall ran across the top. On a clear day, this monumental structure is visible from 12 miles away, gleaming white amid the green and gray mountaintops. Imagine the ambassador of Babylonia, who's seen everything, said Schachner. And then he turns his corner and sees this building that's as spectacular as anything in Mesopotamia or Egypt. I've seen a lot of sights, and I can't think of any that are as spectacular from a long way away as this one. This is how they executed control over the landscape. Amazingly, Hattusa is still yielding new discoveries. The day after my trip up the mountain with Schachner, I returned to the summit to meet Zhenk at Yerkapi, and found him at the mouth of a tunnel that passes underneath the rampart. He stood in an arched passageway that's about 9 feet tall, 230 feet long, and wide enough to accommodate two people walking side by side. As I entered the unlit tunnel, I became acutely aware of the hundreds of tons of dirt and rock above our heads. Zhenk, the grandson of a stonemason, wasn't worried. This is all interconnected, like a tapestry made of stone, he said, gesturing to the tunnel walls. It takes really fine masons to make this. Halfway down the passageway, we stopped, bending low. Zhenk showed me a pinkish, palm-sized painting on the stone wall, a symbol, one of 249 that he discovered in the tunnel in 2022. With each glyph representing a word, the symbols had somehow gone unnoticed by the hundreds of archaeologists and hundreds of thousands of curious tourists who have passed through the tunnel since it was rediscovered in 1834. Since Jenk's find, made with the light of his cell phone, Schachner has worked with imaging specialists to scan the tunnel's interior, creating a 3D model that might help scientists fathom the symbol's significance. For example, some marks appear in threes, like the glyphs for mountain and path, and the symbol representing the holy mountain Terhaya, or Tilhaya, as well as by the god of the same name. Maybe it's meant to say the path through Mount Tilhaya, Schachner said. Far from the tunnel, symbols on a very different wall have provided critical information on the reach and power of the Hittites. When archaeologists in Egypt uncovered the funeral temple of Pharaoh Ramesses II, also known as Ramesses the Great, they found references to a battle that remains perhaps the Hittites' most enduring contribution to history. In this temple complex along the Nile River, Ramesses, one of Egypt's strongest rulers, documented the most memorable moments of his reign, including his 1274 BC battle with the forces of the Hittite king Mudwatalis II at Kadesh, an ancient city not far from modern-day Damascus. A floor-to-ceiling relief depicts the pharaoh's heroics in the face of what he claimed were nearly 50,000 Hittite warriors. Egyptian and Hittite chariots wheel and charge as a larger-than-life Ramesses surveys the bloody chaos. Today, many historians consider the Battle of Kadesh the biggest chariot battle ever fought. Rather than a resounding victory for Ramesses, though, the clash was probably more of a stalemate. In the aftermath, the frontier separated the two empires barely shifted. Relations between the two powers remained unresolved for 15 years until Ramesses and Mudwalis' successor worked out the world's oldest known parity treaty. Inscribed on tablets of silver with copies made in clay, the 1259 BC Accord promised a mutual assistance against invaders and a good peace and a good fraternity between the land of Egypt and the land of Hatti, or Haiti, forever. The agreement marched a pivotal shift in the annals of statecraft. Up until that moment, the rule was winner-take-all. Peace treaties were the winner dictating to losers, Schachner pointed out. The Hittites and the Egyptians decided not to continue that way. The Treaty of Kadesh describes the two rulers as equals and peace as an end in itself. It's the beginning of modern diplomacy. One reason a copy of the agreement hangs at the United Nations headquarters in New York City. A fragmented clay original found at Hattusa in 1906 is on display at the Istanbul Airport Museum. Diplomacy and religion were crucial tools for the Hittites, who referred to their empire as the land of a thousand gods. when they conquered or took control of a group of people, they permitted the subjugated to keep their religious practices. Rather than wiping out local deities, they folded them into the Hittite Empire and Pantheon. Holy statues from temples thought to embody the gods themselves were transported to Hattusa's temple district and worshipped there the way they were at home. Temple archives record the problems with this approach, like gods who didn't speak Hittite. In one example, after a new god was brought from the island of Lesbos, the Hittites realized that no one knew how to talk it. A sheep was sacrificed, and its innards were examined to determine if the new god could accept being worshipped Hittite style. Yes, was the answer discerned in the sheep's intestines. They didn't want to anger the gods. Wilhelm Ball, a Hittitologist at Leiden University in the Netherlands, told me. But at the same time, they're very pragmatic. It's kind of adorable, he added. It was also a key to their success. They were able to bring people together, not by brutal despotism, but by persuasion, using religion and belief, Schachner said. That is unique. That is what makes them so special. What we know about the Hittites is, by the standards of ancient history, incredibly new. Hittite writing wasn't unlocked until 1915, when a linguist in Prague named Biedrich Hrunci realized that the unearthed tablets were written in an Indo-European language, the earliest known example of a family that today includes everything from English to Sanskrit. Over the past century, more than 30,000 remnants of clay tablets have been discovered from recovered from Hattusa and other Hittite cities. More are found every year. That constant flow of brand new information makes Hittitology one of the most dynamic, fast-moving fields of ancient history. Late one afternoon, I found Daniel Schwimmer, a researcher from Germany's University of Würzburg, sitting at a table in the German Archaeological Institute's dig house in Bogolatsky, or Bozsakali. That's a village next to Hattusa's ruins. Schwimmer is part of a small community of scholars who specialize in reading and translating Hittite text. Every autumn, he comes to Hattusa to see what's been found during the summer's excavations. It's a bit like unpacking Christmas presents, Schwimmer said. You really never know what you'll get. Each new find has the potential to change what we know about Bronze Age empires. It's an area where history is still in the process of being written, Schwimmer said. Documents are coming out of the ground nobody has seen for thousands of years. Of course, answers to a question at the heart of the Hittite research remain elusive. That question, what happened to them? Well, theories abound, from political unrest to climate change, but a lone explanation seems unlikely to be found. There's no single reason why such a complex society disintegrates and completely disappears from history, Schachner said. Instead, a perfect storm of factors probably pushed the Hittites to the limits and then beyond. Raiders were a constant threat, for example. Tribes known as the Kaska, living along the Black Sea coast, show up in tablets destroying temples and desecrating statues before dividing up the priest, holy priest, the priestesses, the anointed ones, the musicians, singers, the cooks, the bakers, the plowmen, and the gardeners, and making them their servants. Natural disasters, too, strained the Hittite Empire from time to time. Recent finds from a site called Sapanuva suggest powerful earthquakes regularly rock the Hittite heartland. About 40 miles northeast of Hattusa, at Sapanuva's palace and temple complex, excavations revealed walls and floors that rippled like waves. Archaeologists discovered buildings and storehouses consumed in a huge fire. All clues the city was hit by a devastating quake. The Hittites successfully handled these and different challenges for years until suddenly they didn't. By around 1250 B.C., the tablets began to show the strains of the empire's final century. Palace infighting and royal assassination attempts grew rampant, making it hard for Hattusa's leaders to maintain control over their subjects. Epidemic diseases were a problem, too. The tablets contained prayers to ward off plagues. And changes in language and writing styles in the empire's final decades may be signs of social strife or upheaval, signs their multi-ethnic state was under strain. The latest findings suggest climate change and a series of natural disasters help accelerate the empire's decline. In a 2023 study, researchers analyzed preserved wood recovered from Gordian, a city built on the western outskirts of the Hittite Empire. By measuring tree rings, they could tell nearby forests were unusually stressed between 1198 and 1196 BC, evidence of a punishing three-year drought right around the time the Hittite Empire was ending. The drought may have sparked famine. Archaeologists found empty grain depots at Hattusa, Sapanuva, and other abandoned Hittite cities. Letters reflect the desperation of Hittite kings who begged foreign leaders to send barley and wheat as a matter of life and death. And invaders referred to as sea peoples in Egyptian chronicles called chaos that rippled all across the Mediterranean, weakening old alliances and prompting mass migrations. That was the salt and pepper on the dish, said Jenk. Around 1180 BC, the Hittites methodically abandoned their capital. There are no signs of battle or conquest, no mass graves, no toppled towers or buildings. Temple storehouses full of gold and silver vessels, gilded spears and booty from successful military campaigns, elaborately described in festival instructions and inventory lists but missing today, must have been packed up and evacuated. Afterward, the city burned, but in the final irony, the flames that destroyed Hattusa preserved its story. Too heavy to move from their archives, the thousands of clay tablets the Hittites amassed over the course of roughly four centuries were left behind. Fire baked them into hard bricks, helping them survive the ensuing centuries intact. The advantage for us is that all these clay tablets were left behind when everyone fled, the capital swimmer said. What remained was the paperwork. Until a tablet emerges inscribed with an account of Hattusa's last days, the mystery abides. The Hittites managed to adapt to a harsh environment and grow into a mighty empire despite their surroundings, until circumstances beyond their control upset their delicate balancing act. The Hittites' collapse and their recent rediscovery is a testament to the importance of resilience and good record keeping. Well, we're going to wind up today's journey with a 50,000 steps in a city where the sidewalk never ends. Maya Garnieri's article appeared in the February 3, 2025 issue of the New York Times. And she states in the subhead, in Montevideo, Uruguay, the nearly 14-mile waterside promenade La Rambla serves as an outdoor living room for locals. It's also a perfect antidote for visitors' winter blues. And it says, for a window into the soul of a city, take a stroll along the waterfront. Think of the Seine walkways in Paris, Copacabana promenade in Rio, or the Charles River Esplanade in Boston. Or the nearly 14-mile palm fringe ribbon called La Rambla in Montevideo, the capital of Uruguay. One of the longest sidewalks in the world, the La Rambla meanders along the shimmering estuary Rio de la Plata, past beaches, wine bars, and purple blossoming jacaranda trees, statues and sculptures, soccer matches and friends engrossed in conversations over cups of yerba mate. If you go in the summer, as the northern hemisphere shivers in the cold, in other words, our winter time, you may find yourself part of a mass migration of locals toting folding chairs to the promenade, turning it into essentially the city's outdoor living room. The promenade stitches together different pieces of Montevideo, a city of about 1.3 million, socially as well as geographically. On it, you'll find Uruguayans from all social strata. It's the city's thermometer, said Natalia Zinchuk, a Montevideo native and author. And she described all this to me. She said, with my own thermometer dipping and my imagination stoked, I planned an early winter long weekend in Montevideo, a flowered speckled city that melds old world and modernist architecture to boost my spirits, and my own rambled on La Rambla. Now, the author starts at an amusement park called Parque Rodó. On a balmy Friday morning, I set out on foot from my home base, the Palladium Business Hotel, at the edge of the fashionable Positos neighborhood, and head toward Parque Rodó, an urban gem of a park a few miles west of La Rambla. The red and white striped promenade runs between a busy road and Rio de la Plata, a wide waterway separating Uruguay and Argentina. The path follows a roughly west-east axis, changing names as it winds from the Campiro neighborhood northwest of the Old City to the high-end Caracasco area in the east. The most popular section runs from the Old City to Positos. While heading west to La Rambla, I saw sailboats bobbing outside the century-old yacht club Uruguayo. Women sat on a grassy knoll, their young children toddling about. Two friends on a bench appeared to be deep in conversation over bread and strawberries. A couple sipped a cup of mate, a caffeinated drink common in South America, from the same metal straw. Near a busy skateboard park, I passed some food trucks, including Soya Pepe del Rey, or El Rey, de las Tortafritas, and that's a chuckle-inducing translation. I am Pepe, the king of fried bread. At the Playa de los Positos, a handful of shirtless men played soccer on the sand. I stepped in front of a granite plaque to read Sonnet to a Psalm, or Palm, by the Uruguayan poet Juana de Ibarruel, and was moved by its final stanza likening a palm tree to an eternal homeland. Well, Parque Rodó, the destination of that leg of my ramble, includes an amusement park, a lake where you can rent a paddle boat, a castle housing a small children's library, the National Museum of Visual Arts, and a modest flea market. I happened upon a small plaza with benches ringing an octagonal water fountain. Both bore tiles embellishing with an arabesque design that reminded me of the Middle East. I rested on a bench, enjoying the feel of the tiles hot beneath my bare legs, and thought of the winter winds howling back in the United States. The architecture of Montevideo ranges from old world to modernist, with many beautiful buildings lining La Rambla. La Rambla strings together neighborhoods with distinct architectural styles, as well as heritage sites and parks. With dozens of statues and other works of art, it is a tentative candidate for UNESCO's list of World Heritage Sites. Its entry calls it a veritable open-air gallery. Some have described La Rambla as though a line uniting the history's uniting the country's past, present, and future. Uruguayan artist and writer Gustavo Remedy said the promenade ties together a city that has a tendency to fall apart. Marcelo Figueiredo, author of the nonfiction book Rambla, which offers a detailed look at the waterfront walkway, told me the promenade was both a limit and an escape, a border between Montevideo and the rest of the world. Back on city streets, I headed toward the Positos neighborhood, wandering garden-like lanes rich with architectural details, and then contrasting lines and curves of Art Deco. Venetian and Oriel windows and red roofs all filled this picture. I glimpsed hand-painted floor tiles and smelled caramelized sugar through the open doorway of Camomila, where I enjoyed a lemon tart and a cortado in a small, sun-dappled courtyard. On my way back to La Rambla, I stopped at a second-hand store, 3B Bueno Bonito Barreto. That's good, cute, cheap. And I had a lot of fun, even though it was narrow and cluttered. And there, my friends, we'll end today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it, and she'll be with us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have comments or questions, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.